It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a lot of universities around the country have been debating whether or not to include trigger warnings on academic materials. We'll talk to a guest who says we don't need warning label policies in classrooms.
But first, we take a look at the intersection of technology and medicine, where things are moving quickly and have the potential to change healthcare as we know it.
Futurist Rebecca Ryan joins us in studio now. She's the founder and co-owner of Next Generation Consulting. Rebecca, good to see you again.
And wonderful to see you.
Well, let's get caught up now. What has been catching your eye in terms of that intersection we were talking about where technology and medicine are taking us?
Well, one of the things that people may have seen recently are these new glasses that correct colorblindness, And you can buy them for $277 on Amazon. And for those of you who remember being in school and doing the colorblindness test, if you passed, good on you. If you did not pass, $277 will make it right.
That's so interesting. So we can correct colorblindness with glasses. How does it work?
Well, I am not a scientist, but this is my understanding. Our ability to see, for example, if you say something that makes me blush, like your last guest may have, the ability for you to see me blush has to do with how we pick up pigment. So this neuroscientist recognized this and he said, well, it would be really helpful for people to be able to see blushing or in the lab environment to see more definition around blood cells. So he invented these glasses. And then with an entrepreneur, he said, we're going to go to the TV studios because HDTV would love to see brighter colors, more pigment, and not so much, but they realized sort of accidentally, this also corrects colorblindness. So, ta-da, here we have the AO2s.
That is interesting. It could help solve some arguments with my husband and I about green and brown.
Oh, wow. I did not think about divorce mitigation, but that
right.
is an awesome application.
Obviously an application to think about. Let's go to nanomedicine. Now, nanotechnology has been around for a long time, but it's always driving forward. And there's some really cool new stuff going on with nanomedicine. What are you seeing there?
Well, this is actually a cool little backstory. So, you know, IBM has been working on, like, you know, big data and all this kind of stuff. And this brainiac scientist doctor from the Institute of Bioengineering and Nanotechnology in Singapore approached one of the lead researchers at IBM and said, enough with this big data. You need to be helping me solve the healthcare issues of the world. And he sort of said, okay. So they have got a few really cool inventions. Like the first one is, for any of you who know what MRSA is, I think a lot of wrestlers know what this is. It's a boil. It starts on your skin. It's highly contagious through skin-to-skin contact, and it can be deadly. And they together have developed a nanoparticle that will attack this and kill it, right? And it's completely biodegradable. So it's not, you know, sometimes chemotherapy, it both kills the pathogen, but it also harms the person. And a lot of these nanoparticles don't do that, which is super exciting.
Right, especially for hospitals. Hospitals are very worried about MRSA right now. So is this something that's available now, or is it still sort of in the trials?
This is the three that these guys are working on right now are in beta, but I think the MRSA nanoparticle is, I think you could sign up for a trial now if you had it. I mean, this is a big challenge for healthcare facilities.
Oh, yeah. And along that same line, we are seeing some nanoparticles being used to deliver drugs.
Yeah. So for those of you who know or love somebody who's had breast cancer, he or she has probably been treated with Herceptin. And what these scientists have been able to do is figure out how to bind Herceptin into a liquid gel so that it kind of goes directly to the tumor. And the efficacy rate is amazing. Like if you have Herceptin delivered in this nanoparticle way, you are killing 70% of the tumor compared to when Herceptin is just delivered via chemotherapy and the tumor isn't shrinking at all. So it's terrific.
So some big stuff coming down
Huge.
The pike there. That's so interesting. And this is one that also works on delivery of dosage, intelligent pills.
Yeah. So Philips has this intelligent pill. So for those of your listeners who take a multivitamin every day, it's about the size of a multivitamin and your medication is in it. So you pop the pill. And this is being used for GI issues like Crohn's disease, colon cancer. And the pill distributes the medicine in just the right dose internally. So it's not a shot. It's not a pill. It's a smart pill. So it's giving you these doses over time. And then your body naturally does what it does with the pill itself.
That sounds like a nice way to make sure you get the exact dosage if people are worried about that.
Totally.
Well, moving on to surgery now. So a given is that surgery is expensive, right? In the United States, surgery is expensive. You hope your insurance carrier will pay for it, but there are people who are working on cheaper surgery, and we've got some news from India there.
Yeah, and India is kind of like one example of countries that have large populations and large pools of patients, but not a lot of money. So they need to figure out, how do we do really efficient delivery of things for many, many, many people. And so I think a lot of the healthcare innovation about how healthcare is delivered, the future of medicine, is in some of those countries. But one of the things that has existed in India for a while is $100 cataract surgery.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not hearing you right, but yet I am. $100 cataract surgery. How do you pull that off?
Well, you focus on having the cost of treatment be as low as possible. You figure out how to pull apart all the parts of the surgery so that the most skilled surgeons are doing the most important and specialized parts of the surgery. So all the parts of the surgery that somebody with lower skills can learn to do, they would do those parts of the surgery. And they figured out how to bring the cost of the ocular lens that you need to replace the lens that gets taken out be very, very low. So it's pretty amazing what's happening
there. So they break it down sort of to its component parts and make sure that it's exactly the most efficient, cost-effective way to do it.
Yeah, it's like what Henry Ford would have done with the assembly line. It's similar.
Well, which begs the question, if I can get $100 cataract surgery in India, I'm going to feel ripped off if I get one here and I'm paying thousands of dollars. And this is the kind of question which has people, a growing trend of medical tourism, I guess you call it.
Yeah, 75,000 Americans last year went to other countries to get something done. Can you guess what some of the most common treatments were that they got?
I would say dentistry and plastic surgery.
For sure. Those are the top two, but in the reverse order. So first cosmetic surgery, then dentistry, and then heart surgery.
Heart surgery?
I know. It's crazy.
Where do people go for cheap heart surgery?
I cannot tell you. I don't know, actually. But the CDC, this is interesting, they put out a yellow pages for medical tourism and increasingly transplant tourism.
Oh, boy.
So you need a kidney? I'll tell you where to go.
So you'd think that would augur some changes in our healthcare system here. We don't want people going elsewhere to get medical treatment, do we?
Oh, there are tons of questions about whether it's safe, whether it's ethical. You know, is it ethical? We know that the top, can you call them exporting countries of kidneys, for example, are China, the Philippines, and Pakistan.
Wow. Well, so that's something we'll be watching for sure. That's going to keep on developing. And let's talk next about 3D printers. Now, this is this thing we've heard a lot about. Usually you hear it for applications that don't involve necessarily health, certainly things in the body. What are we seeing there?
Well, so a couple of years ago, this kid at the University of Wisconsin, Eric Ronning, won an award because he was able to print on a 3D printer a fully functioning hand. Now, this is really cool because if you're an amputee, the idea of getting a fully functioning hand is very exciting. But what's really a mind blower is the cost is coming down so much, you could print this at home for $20.
Wow.
Need a hand? $20 later, you've got one. But the other thing that's interesting about 3D printing is, you know, that 3D hand that student created, that was made of plastic, right? Now we are doing bioprinting. So what scientists can literally do is break down human cells from biopsies or stem cells. They put them in a petri dish, right? And so what happens is you get sort of this biological ink. It gets fed into the 3D printer, and then you can print organs, body parts. It's all possible.
That's almost too much for my brain to understand. I hear your words and my brain is trying to compute at the same time, but it's happening.
This is why I enjoy being on your show. Just the inner meltdown.
Right.
For all of you listening, she looks terrific, even though she seems to be melting down internally.
Definitely. Maybe I need to 3D print a new brain or something, but this is going to happen. It sounds like it's going to change the way that we work with people in hospitals.
Well, if you think about it, if we can print a new kidney at home, maybe we don't need to do transplant tourism. Just saying.
All right. Well, let's go on. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. Robotics. Now, this is fascinating. In Japan, apparently, I'm zeroing in on probably not the big picture thing, but robots are already being used, you've said, to work with the elderly, and they teach exercise classes.
Yeah, there's this little like 12-inch robot. He's about a foot tall, and he leads exercise classes. So he does the activity, and all of the elders in the pensioners' home repeat the activity. So it's a way to keep the elders active, their elders active. But what's even more exciting, I think, is that the Japanese government is investing to bring the cost of robotics down to the point where people wouldn't have to go to a nursing home. So these are robots that are amazing. They're able to help elders with all their acts of daily living, from getting out of bed. They remind them to take their medications if they need them. They help them use the bathroom. All the things that you might want an in-home nurse to help with, the robots are going to be able to do.
Wow, it's so fascinating. We could keep going, but we're out of time. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
I'll see you again.
All right, that was Rebecca Ryan, an economist, author, and futurist. She's the founder and co-owner of Next Generation Consulting.
Trigger warnings. A lot of universities are debating whether or not to include trigger warnings at the beginnings of classes.
To be clear, trigger warnings for students are defined in the New York Times as explicit alerts that the material they are about to read or see in a classroom might upset them. That can be as broad as violent material, misogynist material, sexist material, and the list goes on.
So the idea is this will trigger a reaction, a traumatic response or emotional response, something like that. Our next guest says, well, we don't actually need new warning label policies. We've got David Perry with us. He's Associate Professor of History at Dominican University in Illinois. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, how widespread are these? I first encountered them on the internet over the last year or so. Are a lot of universities and colleges considering trigger warning policies?
I think so far it's only a handful of universities have gotten to the point of actually drafting policy language, but I think it's fair to say that every university is paying attention to this conversation and thinking about what is this going to mean for us. So yes, it's a big conversation throughout the world of higher education right now.
And you're not on board with the idea. What is the argument against, especially a university-wide policy on trigger warnings?
Right. So I want to say that there's a lot of people who are arguing about this who I think are not understanding what the debate is. Mm-hmm. This is not about people feeling uncomfortable. It's not about people who just don't want to do the reading or who don't like the reading. It's not about political correctness. These are words that are thrown around in the debate. But this is about trauma and how we should deal with it in the classroom. And so people who are for the policy are saying that, I think reasonably, that students who are experiencing a traumatic reaction based on something they're encountering, that they're not going to learn. And so we need these warnings to help students so they don't have to choose between their education and being safe. Critics, like me, I hope also, as sort of a reasonable counterargument, say, first of all, education needs difficult material. We can't sanitize the kinds of things that we teach. But also that it's the nature of trauma, the nature of triggers, is highly personal. And who am I? I'm a history professor. I haven't done psychological evaluations of every one of my students to guess, well, maybe this will be traumatic or that won't be. People can be triggered by such things as, yes, graphic depictions of violence, but also the smell of lavender or the taste of almonds. It could be whatever, a particular kind of window. Anything that that relates to their trauma could be triggering. And so I have some real questions about the practicality of any kind of blanket policy.
The classic use of trigger warnings when I've seen them, especially, again, on the internet, I haven't been in a university classroom in a while, is some kind of depiction or graphic description of sexual assault in particular, possibly triggering a traumatic response from a survivor of sexual assault. Whether it's a university-wide policy or not, is that bad an idea for a professor or someone presenting a material that includes that kind of depiction for some reason to give a heads up?
I don't think it's a bad idea at all. And in fact, I can't imagine teaching a class in which there would be some kind of graphic description of sexual assault or torture or any kind of explicit violence in which I would not have told my students what they were going to encounter. I guess I don't do it because I'm worried about triggers, although I think about it all the time, but because it's just really good teaching that, as opposed to in a TV show where you might want to surprise the viewer so that they gasp and say, oh no, I didn't expect that to happen. In the classroom, I say, this is what you're going to read. These are the things I'd like you to think about. These are some of the things you might encounter. Here are some questions to take home with you. And so I think it's a fine idea to tell students what they're going to encounter. And if that helps with trigger issues, which I think it does, that's really good. I actually think you can cover a lot of the bases by just practicing good teaching and preparing your students for the work they're going to do.
Now, you mentioned some of the reaction you've seen from critics worried about political correctness, to saying that, a lot of literature might include material that is racist or sexist, and these trigger warnings could expand to maybe be overprotective of students' exposure to these materials. You're not seeing that happening on campuses, even ones that are considering trigger warnings.
Well, I'm not. And it's always a challenge when you teach material that contains objectionable language or ideas. I teach a lot about medieval violence between Christians and Muslims and Jews, ideas about anti-Semitism, all kinds of things that are deeply objectionable. That's important. These are important things to teach, important to talk about, important to complicate and discuss. No one has ever said, as a Jew or as a Christian or as a Muslim, I'm incapable of having this conversation. That said, if someone's going to sit down and read a story about that's saying something horrible about another group of people, it is worth preparing them for that so they know what the context is. They know what's going on here. They know both that these ideas are objectionable, but also that just because one person from one particular era said something, we don't have to reject everyone else from that era. Or if one author has a character that does something terrible or says something terrible, that doesn't mean we have to simply ascribe those views to the author, that there's complexity here.
Talk a little more about your concept of good teaching to deal with these issues and bring students on board, and I guess putting these things in context.
Well, all the people who study reading, I teach history, but there are people who spend all their time studying reading. And what they like to talk about is scaffolding, that students read better when they read with a clear purpose, and that when you send them home, or for that matter, if you're showing a film in the middle of class or reading something in class, you want to tell your students, this is the goal of the class. That if you just say, go home and read chapter one, or go home and read the first three acts of Hamlet, you're not actually doing your job as a teacher. You should say, go home and read the first three acts of Hamlet, and here are some of the things you're going to encounter. Here are the things I'd like you to think about. And if there was going to be something that was graphic and shocking in a reading, I would think that would be necessary to prepare them on some level. Otherwise, the students will likely spend all their time being shocked, whether triggered or not, and not thinking about whatever your course themes are, historical content, literary form, whatever it is that you're trying to teach.
And as we mentioned, this is happening on some colleges, some universities, considering having these trigger warning guidelines, policies. If, say, your college put something like this into effect, would that stand in the way of you doing this kind of good teaching, this kind of contextualizing of the material?
My real concern is that it would push us into being risk-averse as teachers. There's a lot of this going on. I link it to the sort of the general corporate pressures on the university and a lot of sort of business language and business speak, which are pushing universities in general to try to avoid lawsuits, to put it bluntly. And surely many administrators who are backing these kinds of policies have the interest of the students in mind. But I do think at least some extent it's an attempt to put warning labels. I write about it as the equivalent of putting on your syllabus, warning, this coffee is hot, so that if you burn yourself, you're not going to get a lawsuit. And that's not, I mean, that looks good, but it's kind of a Band-Aid, vague policy that doesn't actually fix anything. And I do worry that then once we've slapped one of these labels on, that then the cases where there are serious cases of trauma, that we might think, well, we've done all we need to do. And I'm not sure that's true either. I'm not sure that, in fact, just saying there's graphic content in this reading is enough for people who are, in fact, sexual assault survivors. Or I've had students who've experienced death in the family during a semester, the semester before, and that these are much more complicated situations than a warning label or a content note can take care of.
We're talking to David Perry. He's an associate professor of history at Dominican University in Illinois. Over this concept of trigger warnings, the idea that, say, a university lecture or a university or college as a whole should warn people about content that might trigger a traumatic response, maybe a strong emotional response. Should this be a policy at schools? It's not all over the place yet, but it's getting a lot of attention in the media and in academia in general.
We're continuing our discussion about trigger warnings with David Perry, Associate Professor of History at Dominican University in Illinois.
And we want to know what you think about the concept. And these trigger warnings would be something like at the beginning of a class, maybe a warning that some content will depict a sexual assault or maybe a traumatic episode of war that might trigger something for somebody who had survived one of those two things. Some universities, colleges are being called on by students and others to have blanket policies on trigger warnings. Our guest, David Perry, says, no, we don't need that. There are better ways to teach related to these issues. Want to hear what you think? 800-642-1234. Are you a student? Would you like to see something like this in place at your school, your college, your university? Are you in academia? Good idea? Bad idea? Do you have a question? 800-642-1234, or you can always email us at talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Christine on the line in Platteville. Christine, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
What do you think about this?
I personally think that including a trigger warning statement in the syllabus or, you know, discussed even in class would be a good thing because there's so many people in colleges from so many different backgrounds, you know, so many different veterans, people who've been through sexual assault, that can help them prepare themselves mentally before they delve into the book. And I'm not saying necessarily avoiding the book because of it, because sometimes reading through things can help you cope. But it helps get you ready for it or make that decision yourself.
Christine, thanks a lot for that call. David, do you think as an instructor that might make sense?
It will be fine. I mean, I have no objection to that. I worry about, again, when it becomes mandatory policy and the implications of what happens when an administration says these are the things you have to mark out and they choose, well, these five kinds of different difficult content you've got to label and not five other kinds, exactly for the reason Christine just said, that people come from so many different backgrounds. Making sure students are ready to are preparing themselves mentally for difficult material, I'm absolutely in favor of that. And if there are teachers who aren't doing that, well, then that is an issue. But again, I'm concerned about using a blanket kind of vague policy in order to ensure that happens.
Christine, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Catherine in Dousman now. Catherine, hi there.
Hi, I'm a high school English teacher, and I can't imagine teaching a piece of literature without scaffolding it. I'm agreeing with your guest in that way, that you try to prepare the students for what they may encounter, but at the university level, it's so important to be a critical thinker, and, you know, when you get to college, you're expecting, as a student, to be able to navigate all this and handle this, and it is the professor's responsibility to help you navigate it. And, you know, so many different individuals. So I'm just calling to agree wholeheartedly with the guest that a blanket ruling coming from administration would not be a way to go, especially in a university environment.
And Catherine, as a high school teacher, you mentioned that scaffolding. What's an example of a book that maybe was controversial or could have been offensive or triggering to a student that you scaffolded around?
Well, I used to teach The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn to freshmen. And it uses the N-word quite frequently, and so we put it in the historical context beforehand and did a lot of study of Twain's life and showed how, you know, he was disturbed by slavery and used this character. And, of course, we always gave students the option, if you think that this is not a book that you can read, then you should, you know, we'll find an alternative for you. But the majority of the time, students chose to read the book. And I had one student in American Lit this year who said, you know, I said, do you think that you're going to be bothered? And he said, I'll think about it. He took the book home, came back and said, my mom convinced me I should read the book. So,
all right.
You know.
Catherine, thank you so much for sharing that story. It sounds like she's doing it right, David.
Sounds great to me. You know, the one thing I want to add that we haven't talked about is there is a small percentage of people with, or maybe a larger percentage of people, with kind of diagnosed trauma. And the word that, one word that's been missing from this conversation is the word of disability. PTSD is a disability. Anxiety disorders based on trauma is a disability. And that's a situation where we don't need a new policy because we already have a policy. It's called the American with Disabilities Act. And every university should have means of helping students who really can't encounter certain kinds of things without real breakdowns in the middle of class. This is something that maybe not every university is doing it as well as they could, but we do have these policies based on the ADA in order to make sure we help students deal with these situations.
But if you're a professor, you don't know that the student in the back row there has PTSD and might need some extra, you know, some extra right. conversation with you.
And it is not only my job, but I don't mean it as an avoidance. Mm-hmm. I should not be asking students, can you tell me about your sexual assault or your experience mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, right? We should have confidential, highly trained disability advocates and specialists to work with those students, generate reasonable accommodations, and then bring them to the instructor. And I always say the request for an accommodation should be the beginning of a conversation. It's not, oh, you've given me a piece of paper that these things have to happen. Well, that's when we start talking about it. And it's not that you can just ignore an accommodation, but you can say what's reasonable within the context of this class and have a dialogue. I have never had someone bring an accommodation based on content they could or couldn't encounter. And in fact, in many cases with trauma, as I've been learning, avoidance is not the best therapy for trauma. But we do have these mechanisms, and at many universities, they're wonderful. I'm sure other universities can still work on making those systems more robust and efficient and caring, but we do have them.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Nick on the line in Sussex. Nick, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I guess I just kind of briefly cut in, I missed calling, and you mentioned something about PTSD, and mm-hmm. I'm an Army Reservist myself, and so obviously I know plenty of war veterans, and I know PTSD can come out very suddenly and can be very quickly invoked by many things, and especially I know I'm a university student at UWM, and I know a lot of the classes I've taken have pretty graphic war-related material, and I know a lot of quite a number of veterans that go to UWM, and we have nothing in place that says, like, hey, there's just nothing in place for, like, warning students that, hey, there could be graphic material, and et cetera, et cetera. So obviously the same goes for sexual assault victims. But I guess there should be something like if they know you're a veteran and you're attending the class, they should warn the student or tell the teacher, hey, you should kind of be conscious of what you're showing. Because even though he might not say he has PTSD, because obviously a lot of PTSD also goes undiagnosed. So who knows when something could be invoked or when the student could have an episode, et cetera, et cetera. And the same goes, like I said, for sexual assault victims who oftentimes won't even, obviously don't report sexual assault. They don't even know that it could be a problem. So, again, there should be something in place saying, I guess like on the syllabus or something, saying if you were a victim of sexual assault or anything traumatic, just feel free to leave the class at any time, no questions asked. Just there should be a lot more accommodation and accessibility and also confidentiality for victims of traumatic events.
Nick, thank you so much. You bring up a lot of issues. One thing I wonder there, David, we've got a lot of veterans in many campuses around the country. Is academia on top of these issues of dealing with PTSD and the needs of veterans?
I think it is an emerging conversation in academia, and I wish we were more ahead of it. I think some universities and some individual faculty, often people from a military background, are way ahead of it. I don't have a military background, but I talk to people who do and learn a lot about it. Some universities are doing wonderful work, have special programs, have special sort of helping veterans navigate their way through higher education kinds of programs, and other universities are a little behind on it. I'd like to see much more of that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Nick. We've got Mark in Appleton on the line now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I also teach. I've had students with PTSD and certainly make accommodations for them. I just wonder, though, whether we're putting the onus on the faculty and on the syllabus instead of making it on the student to be responsible to ask the professor before the class, is there this kind of material, or to, in other words, that it's the student's responsibility to put themselves and keep them out of a situation that might be harmful to them, instead of asking the professor to do it. It just seems, I just question.
Gotcha, Mark. David, it's up to the student to, if they've got a need like that, to make it clear to the professor up front.
Well, I think it would be difficult for me to say to a student, you have to disclose your status as a rape survivor to me. That's not a conversation I think a student should have to have with every faculty member as they move through a university. But again, if we do have robust student services and disability services, and if as professors we just teach empathetically and respectfully and we think about what is our material and who our students are, I do feel that we're going to take care of a lot of these cases before it comes up, and that to some extent students are taking responsibility. It's the students who are driving this conversation, who are asking for these policies, and we need to listen to them. That doesn't mean we have to enact the policy that they're requesting, but we do at least have to be very open to the conversation and thinking about what happens in our classroom.
We'll leave it there. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was David Perry, Associate Professor of History at Dominican University in Illinois. It's time for Wisconsin Life. When you live in Wisconsin, you're never far from a lake. Writer Jill Sisson Quinn moved here from Maryland, a state with many streams and rivers, not so many lakes. She's been learning the difference.
I grew up near LODIC, or flowing waters. The Maryland Department of Natural Resources website on bays and streams asks, did you know that everyone in Maryland lives within minutes of a stream? But presently, I live in a lentic, or stillwater, environment. To Maryland's zero natural lakes, Wisconsin has 13,120. And so, by necessity, I have become a limnologist. I compare and contrast my stream and lake knowledge. A stream goes by you. You happen upon it, a trickle at the bottom of a hill. A stream is a path. But a lake sits with you. Following its edge will only bring you back to your beginning. It takes you to itself. You squat in a stream. You do not swim. You raft, watching the occasional head of a water snake like the curved black end of the staff of some underwater chief angle away from you. A lake, though, a lake holds you up. It is sometimes inaccessible, surrounded by marsh or swamp. Often it will let you enter from only one point, which you have the challenge of finding. A stream brings you closer to something or away. It cuts the earth and the ball of your foot with a piece of what will soon be sea glass. If you follow it, a stream will give you answers. But a lake breeds questions. Who knows if you could swim across, how deep it is, or what lurks beneath its surface? I will not lie. When I sit by a lake in Wisconsin, I still want to stretch it into a stream. But when I enter a lake, everything changes. There is a lake I have come to know, with a pebbled bottom as unsoiled as if the ice had just finished its carving and depositing, with water as cold and clear as if you were swimming in glacial melt itself. When I lie back in this lake, I become part of it. I feel my sense of place shift. As surely as the water in my blood streams through my veins, water pools in my cells, the brain is three-quarters water, the bones one-fifth. I am a lake, a body of water surrounded by land. And that land is Wisconsin, and I am learning to call it home.
Jill Sisson Quinn is a nature writer in central Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. The series is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Emerald ash borer is wreaking havoc on ash trees in the eastern half of the United States. Native to Asia, the first infestations in the U.S. were found in Detroit in 2001. The pest has now spread to 21 states and was first found here in Wisconsin in 2008.
The ash borer is a small, bright green beetle that burrows into all species of ash trees, killing them generally within 2 to 5 years. Ash trees are common in forests and on city streets throughout the state, and their lumber is used for a lot of things, from flooring to baseball bats.
This week has been dedicated as Emerald Ash Borer Awareness Week by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Here with us to talk about the borer here in Wisconsin is Brian Kuhn. He's director of the Plant Industry Bureau at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how much damage have these emerald ash borers done so far in Wisconsin?
Well, in Wisconsin so far, the damage is relatively minimal compared to surrounding states and states to our east, where EAB has killed something on the order of 50 million ash trees. But we are starting to see its impact down in the very southeast corner of the state where tree mortality is becoming visible.
And we used to talk in terms, it seemed like, of keeping emerald ash borer out of Wisconsin. Is that's not really the conversation anymore, is it?
No. The conversation is again, more about trying to limit and slow its movement across the state. Again, on its own, emerald ash borer moves relatively slowly, but as in the case of our infestation in Douglas County, it can move 200 miles in the blink of an eye on firewood or other materials that people carry with them.
And how wide a range does the borer have now in Wisconsin?
It's predominantly in the southern half of the state with, I'd say, the highest level of infestation in the southeast. But we do have EAB for the first time detected up in Douglas County in the very northeast corner in the city of Superior. So again, that was likely moved by people to an area with a large population up there.
Well, let's follow up that issue. For a while, the DNR, the USDA have been calling on people, us, to help stop the spread of emerald ash borer. What kind of difference can people make, especially through this summer?
Yeah, people can make all the difference in the world with emerald ash borer. It's kind of the poster child for an invasive species that is transported predominantly by people. But it is not the only one. There are many other species. If we can get our population, our citizens working to not move firewood long distances, we'll address both emerald ash borer and many other invasive pests that are yet to come our way. But that's the predominant thing is, again, keeping firewood where you cut it, burn it where you buy it, and keeping firewood basically local.
And you cannot travel in Wisconsin, it seems like, without seeing that message. Everywhere I go, I see the don't transport the firewood, use local firewood. Are we listening?
Yes, I think we are definitely seeing response from citizens. The Department of Natural Resources has done some surveys of campground folks that come in and year after year, and the message is getting there year by year with growing numbers. People are identifying that they know about it when they show up in the campgrounds now. So it is a really big issue, and it, again, crosses many different invasive species.
That's just one aspect of trying to control the emerald ash borer. What kind of things is the state looking at doing, or maybe local governments, to try to slow the bug down?
Well, the state is working by doing trapping. We've got about 1,500 traps that are going to go up statewide beginning here in the near future for this year. What we're trying to do is find it early so we can inform communities and citizens about its presence nearby so folks can start managing for it. But many communities are already implementing emerald ash borer management plans because it has such a big impact when you think 20% of our urban trees are ash. And the cities are going to have to be dealing with a lot of ash trees that will be dying from emerald ash borer over time. So they need time to implement their management plans, and those things include activities like treating some trees that are maybe high-value trees, but removing other trees that may be already in declining health and replacing them now to try and diversify that canopy.
And so taking down an infested tree can help stop the spread?
Definitely. Communities are taking down infested trees, chipping those, which will destroy the vast majority, if not all, the emerald ash borer larvae that are in that tree. And the more of those beetles that you can get out of the population, the more impact you can have on slowing its movement.
You mentioned treating high-value trees. We have insecticide that targets emerald ash borers, or is it something that would take out a lot of other bugs, and that's why we're not using it more widely?
Yeah, there are a number of pesticides on the market now that are labeled for treatment of ash trees related to emerald ash borer, but they do often address a broader host of tree pests as well. But again, people are using those on specific trees. It's not inexpensive, but we do now have at least a technology and a treatment that if you have that backyard ash tree that's shading the back patio in the sandbox that you want to retain, there is a tool now for treating that individual tree. Some of those are through injection where the product goes right into the flow system of the tree, and others are root drenches where you pour the material on the surface of the soil where it soaks in and the tree takes it up over time.
You mentioned at the outset that the damage here in Wisconsin hasn't been as bad as some of our neighbors. What's at stake, though? What is at risk if this gets out of hand?
Well, what's at stake in the state is a huge forest resource of about 765 million ash trees across the state. The vast majority of that where we have not detected emerald ash borers in the northern third of the state. In our communities, again, 20% of the street trees that you see when you're driving down the road or in a park are ash trees. To have those go away would really alter people's neighborhoods and landscapes.
And are people in your position maybe swapping stories with people at the USDA in other states looking for success stories to build on?
Certainly. Again, the real goal for us is informing communities, getting communities to take action now, starting to implement emerald ash borer plans. Emerald ash borer is going to have its impact on Wisconsin. It's going to have a significant impact on our forests and our urban forests. But cities and communities can prepare for it, can start, they're taking actions now to minimize the impact or spread the cost of emerald ash borer over decades versus getting just standing there and watching it come. So the proactive approach is a much better approach with communities.
Brian, thanks a lot for taking the time with us.
You bet.
That's Brian Kuhn, Director of the Plant Industry Bureau at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, talking about Emerald Ash Borer Awareness Week across the country. Infestation of the ash borer has been found in 20 counties in Wisconsin.